Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Three American soldiers brutally killed in an attack south of Baghdad last year were inadequately protected and participating in an ill-conceived mission. That's according to a newly released military investigation. The two officers, reportedly responsible, have been removed from their posts, accused of, quote, numerous acts of complacency and a lack of standards. The report, released to the Associated Press, comes as U.S. and Iraqi forces search for three soldiers abducted just 5 days ago under remarkably similar circumstances. Robert Hodierne is senior managing editor at the Army Times Publishing Company, which is independent from the military, and he joins us to discuss this investigation. Welcome.
Thank you, Deborah.
What do you know about the conclusions of this military investigation?
Well, I'm not surprised. I think most people who were following this at all closely thought the idea of posting four guys out there in one Humvee off by themselves was a bit loony. That's Indian country and very dangerous place to be with just four people.
So some of the findings of this investigation, saying it was ill-conceived, it was a bad mission, and some of the folks involved were accused of complacency. I mean, is that unusual to use those kinds of words in a military investigation like this?
I actually thought the use of the term complacency was giving the platoon leader and the company commander a great deal of benefit of the doubt. Complacency seems like the least of it. Incompetence is the word I think that many people would suggest was more appropriate.
And no criminal charges against these officers?
No, it's rare for a criminal charge to be filed just because you screw up. You know, it has to really rise to a level of negligence that is hard to prove, among other things.
Mm. Can you say what these four soldiers were doing in the hinterlands?
They were guarding a bridge, apparently, according to the report, and trying to keep the enemy from blowing the bridge up. It says that the nearest reinforcements were about three-quarters of a mile away, which can be a very long distance. You would see an enemy do in a situation like that is probably ambush the route that the reinforcements would take, sort of a classic insurgent tactic.
So have any steps been taken then by the military to try to make sure that these types of missions weren't authorized and undertaken again?
I suspect that when we find out more about the platoon leader in particular, we'll find that he was probably quite inexperienced. It's what we're seeing a lot of these days. It's hard to staff those positions. It's hard to recruit people to come in and be a young platoon leader. And I suspect one of the other things we'll find out as still more details become available is this particular unit was stretched thin in terms of its area of responsibility. And the lieutenant and captain may felt they had no other choice but to put people out in isolated positions like that. A lot of people in the military believe that there aren't nearly enough people in Iraq to accomplish the kind of mission that they've been given.
There are similarities in this attack, which we've just received the investigation about, and then Saturday's kidnapping in essentially the same area. What do you know about that?
Well, what I know about this is that the enemy is becoming a great deal more sophisticated. They are able now to stage more complex attacks, whereas in the past, a couple of years ago, they might have satisfied themselves with the occasional sniper firing away at people and planting hidden explosives along roads. We now see them staging what the military refers to as complex ambushes, and that's a troubling sign.
And what about the fact that this particular attack last June may have been a revenge attack because of the rape and killing of an Iraqi girl and members of her family, and then the Saturday attack may have also been revenge for that same incident for which three U.S. soldiers were found guilty?
I think that it's very hard to know if there was a direct cause and effect relationship, but it is very troubling to everybody in the military that events like that rape and killing are taking place, and the killings in Hamadiyah and Haditha and the incident with the Marine Special Operations Force in Afghanistan. As insurgencies go on, as counterinsurgency operations drag on, most countries have found that the longer it goes on, the more difficult it is to maintain the kind of strict military order and discipline that usually works to prevent incidents like that.
Robert Hodierne, Senior Managing Editor at the Army Times Publishing Company, thanks very much for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
Some U.S. military members who return from overseas deployments face another battle at home over custody of their children. First, we'll hear from Master Sergeant Jane Payer. Before she was sent to Iraq, she was the primary caregiver for her children. But in order to deploy, she had to set up what's called a family care plan, and she transferred custody of her two children to her husband as they were beginning divorce proceedings. When Jane came home, she expected to regain full custody of her kids, but that did not happen. Her case represents a dilemma that some 140,000 single parents in the military face. Fighting for their country may end up costing them their custody rights. And Jane, can you explain what happened to you as you were being deployed?
I was going through a very acrimonious divorce at that time, and I had a temporary court order in place stating that I was the primary parent for my two children. And when I was going through my mobilization process, I had to go to court just before I left, and the judge awarded my ex-husband, he was my husband at the time, temporary custody of the children because I was going to be gone and they were going to be with their father. So upon my return to the state, I had to go back into court to regain custody of my children again because there was nothing in the court order allowing me any parental rights once I was off active duty. And I did go back into court, and that's the time in December of 2004, I was put in a 50-50 rotating custody at that time.
And were there reasons given for that?
The only answer that the judge would give me was that he was concerned. He would never explain what concerned was. There was nothing detrimental going on in my life. I was not, you know, accused of any drug use. I was not pending any criminal charges or anything. There was nothing that was going to make me an unfit mother. So I never got an explanation except for he was concerned. So it was his personal opinion.
How often do you see them now?
Right now, they're still in the rotating custody. They live 1 week with me and 1 week with their father.
How is that arrangement working out?
Not very well at all, actually. And it's been a very tough road for our children. And I'm going to continue to try to get that changed, but it's very difficult. It's very difficult.
And when you first gave your ex-husband, or your then-husband, I guess, temporary custody of the kids, that's something that you're required to do before you deploy, have a plan for your children, with the expectation that you're supposed to have back the same custody agreement that you had when you left.
That's correct. I had even mentioned that to the judge when I was in the courtroom before I left, that I wanted that put into the court order, and that was on advice from a JAG officer that had assisted me and said there may be a problem with this. And I had requested this judge put that in the court order so when I returned, it would be easily put back exactly the way it was when I left, and he wouldn't put it in the court order.
There are some family court judges who have brought up the issue of repeated deployments and saying that that may not allow someone to provide a stable environment for children if they always have to be concerned about when they might be deployed again overseas.
Some people may agree with that, and that's if that's their position, that's great. And if every judge felt that way, then you're not going to have full seats in all the militaries because as an individual, as you know, at some point, if you want to serve your country in any kind of capacity in the military and you won't have protection as a parent, that's going to significantly affect individuals that want to join our services.
So what do you think needs to be done to try to prevent things like this happening from a parent possibly losing some custody rights when they're deployed overseas?
What I think needs to happen is each state is going to need to pass laws protecting parents' rights, service members' parenting rights. And if you leave and you're the primary parent for your children, you'll come back and you'll be the primary parent for your children. As a service member, if I had known prior to leaving that I was going to lose custody of my children, this would have caused me enormous distress because what's my number one job that I have? My number one job is to be a mother. That's the first job I have. And I don't want to sacrifice that for my military career. And I definitely would give up my military career to not lose my parenting time.
Master Sergeant Jane Payer of Tallahassee, Florida, lost partial custody of her children when she went to fight overseas. Jane, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you.
Well, Brad Carlson of Sierra Vista, Arizona, is another soldier who lost custody of his children after being deployed to Iraq in 2003. He was still married when he went overseas, but while he was gone, his wife set up permanent residency in her native Luxembourg. They were divorced while he was still deployed, and he ended up losing custody. Brad, you have three children. How often do you see them now? Are they still in Luxembourg?
Yes, they reside and live in Luxembourg. I see my children one time a year, and the Luxembourg courts, which were granted child custody jurisdiction, gives me the right to visit them three times a year, but due to vacation time and cost, I can only see them one time a year.
And this happened while you were deployed?
Yes, I was deployed to Kuwait and Iraq. In June of 2003, my wife, who was vacationing in Luxembourg, told me she wanted a divorce. So then I filed for divorce from Kuwait.
So can you explain how Luxembourg ended up getting to decide custody?
Since I filed in Arizona, the Arizona courts actually had child custody jurisdiction. But because my children had been out of Arizona for more than 6 months, they gave child custody jurisdiction to the country of Luxembourg.
What was the reason that the Luxembourg courts gave for granting custody to your ex-wife?
They work off the Napoleonic Code. In this case, mothers always get the custody of the kids. My Luxembourg lawyer told me that even if I lived in Luxembourg, I'd still only get to see my kids one day a week. And when I go to visit my kids, that's all I get to do. I get to visit them. I don't get to have them overnight. I don't get to take them anyplace. I just get to visit them, and that's based on the Luxembourg law. And that's not because of anything I have done or haven't done. That's just the way it is.
And so that's essentially why you then testified before the legislature on a bill that would protect other people in your similar situation.
Yes,
and work
exactly.
For that.
Yes, the law, House Bill 2635, protects deployed soldiers when their spouses remove the children from the United States. Unfortunately, it does not protect deployed soldiers when the children are removed to another state, but it's a big victory.
So would you have gone overseas if you knew that this would have happened? What would you have done differently?
No way. I would not have gone overseas if I had foreseen this. I did not know that our country or Arizona did not protect the child custody rights of deployed soldiers. There's no way I would have gone.
So how old are your children now?
9, 7, and 5.
What do they say?
Well, first of all, they call me Bradley at my ex-wife's behest. They don't know me as a father anymore. It's more I'm a visitor in their lives.
Are you working legally to try to change that?
No, I can't. It's a done deal in my case. The only way I could probably change is if I became a resident of Luxembourg. I've had to accept my kids are not going to be part of my life, and, you know, it's tough. It's just really tough.
Brad, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Hey, no problem.
Captain Brad Carlson lost custody of his three children while he was deployed in Iraq. When we come back, we'll talk with a legal expert about what military service members can do to protect their parental rights and why laws set up to protect custody rights don't always work. Later in the show, a look at lying in the workplace. It's Here and Now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. We've been talking about single parents who end up losing custody of their children after being deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan. Several states have passed measures to try and protect service members, but it's a murky area of the law. Joining us with more on this is Victor Hansen. He's a professor at the New England School of Law and a former military lawyer. And Victor, before deploying overseas, what's the process that military service members must go through when dealing with child custody issues?
All of the services have a regulatory requirement that service members who are in sole custody or some kind of custody agreement or arrangement with their children to establish a family care plan if they are in fact a primary caregiver. For example, a common situation, let's say you have a single mother who has one or two children at home, and during a deployment she would have to have a guardianship agreement to, let's say, give guardianship over to a grandmother, an aunt, or somebody else in the family who she's designated to be the family care provider in her absence.
So in Jane's case, we heard that she did that. She transfers custody,
yes,
to her ex, and she expects that when she returns, it would go back to the arrangement that it was before she
right.
left. But then she finds out, nope, you know, she's lost some of her custody rights. So she said that she tried to get it written in there that the custody rights would go back to what they were before, but that didn't happen. Is that what service members should try to do to protect their custody rights while they're deployed?
Well, it's certainly not a bad idea, but her situation really demonstrates kind of the catch-22 situation where a military member may have to rely on their former spouse to be the caregiver in their absence. And then in their absence, of course, that former spouse, like in Jane's case, uses that to their advantage to try to get a modification of the custody agreement.
So what can they do, basically? Can they do anything?
Well, I mean, there is a provision known as the Service Member Civil Relief Act, which is intended to some degree protect a soldier's legal rights while they're deployed, such that a judge should not be entering in judgments or modifications to custody agreements or any other legal actions of this manner while the service member is deployed and the service member has an opportunity to come back and be represented in court. But again, judges don't always follow it. And bottom line, in any custody proceeding, the judge is required to make a decision based upon the best interest of the child.
Do you think that within the system there may be the thinking, as Jane alluded to in a way, that many judges may feel that essentially you cannot be deployed overseas and be a good parent?
I think there certainly is some of that. I mean, it's difficult to overcome that prejudice, and I think it often is a greater impact when, for example, in a situation like Jane's where it's the female, it's the mother, because there is the notion that, boy, if the mother's gone out of the home, and particularly during these recurring deployments, it's going to be creating an unstable situation for the children. And so there, I think, is some belief on the part of judges that a mother cannot, you know, serve both of those roles, to be a full-time mother and a full-time soldier, which is a tough choice, as we could hear from Jane's interview. The tough choice that she has to make then is to whether I'm going to continue my service with the military or whether I'm going to devote my full time and attention to raising my kids and give up my military career.
But say, in a case like hers, if she does lose some of her custody rights, can she get them back? Can those decisions be reversed?
Oh, certainly they can be reversed. I mean, a change in circumstances is always a basis to re-examine a custody situation. So, for example, if Jane, as it seems like, and she was saying in her interview, that she might give up her military career, if she were in fact to do that and go back to the judge and say, Your Honor, I've resigned my military career. I've devoted myself to a full-time mother. I've got a job here locally. I will not be deploying again. My circumstances have changed. Those things can happen, but they cost time, they cost money, they cost attorneys and all of those things.
And what kind of effect would this have on the military?
I mean,
if you tell people, look, you've got to make a choice here. It's either parenting or military service.
You know, and the military tries to be sensitive to that. I mean, back in the old days, I guess in the old Army, the saying was if the Army or the military wanted you to have a spouse, they would have issued you one. And that's kind of a bygone era that is thankfully gone away. But In a more modern Army where we're trying to have a service that represents a greater cross-section of our country, and when the need for soldiers is increased, it does put an increasing tension on the military.
So if there is sort of, you know, this gray area in terms of laws that are on the books in custody cases that not everyone has to follow sometimes because they're custody cases, what advice do you give to single parents who are about to deploy to make sure that they don't lose any of their custody rights?
Well, I think one of the things you have to be honest with them is that there's no guarantees in life, and certainly there's no guarantee that their deployment is not going to affect their custody rights. To the extent possible, you have to be very careful in scrutinizing their family care plan. In Jane's case, where she had her former spouse be the primary caregiver in her absence, if there was any other option or any better option, like a family member, a grandmother, or somebody who's less likely to use this opportunity to go back in and get a modification of the custody agreement, that might have been a better step.
In Bradley's case, he mentioned this sort of six-month rule.
Yes.
That after 6 months, his children were in Luxembourg,
right.
Essentially. Well, what is that six-month rule in terms of the residency of the children and how that plays out in custody cases?
It's not uncommon for many states to, again, because of the focus of in custody situations is on the best interest of the child, the courts will look at where has the child established the most contacts, where are they going to school, where do they have friends, where do they have roots in the community. And there's kind of a notion, and in many cases a statutorily created notion, that once a child has been in a location or jurisdiction 6 months or more, the likelihood is that's where their contacts are going to be the strongest. And so the courts are going to be very hesitant to step in and try to assert their authority once those contacts have been established in another jurisdiction.
But I would expect that in the case of military families, this is particularly difficult.
Oh, because, absolutely, yeah, because of the moves, the deployments, and all of those things. I mean, you know, I did a 20-year career in the military, and if you ask my children where they're from, they'll kind of shrug their shoulders and say, well, I'm from the Army, because they move around so much. And that's often the case. So sometimes these notions of six-month contacts or whatever don't seem to be a very good fit to a military lifestyle. I think that there ought to be, if nothing else, a greater awareness on the part of judges. There needs to be an awareness and an education on their part that the military is a community that does try to support and protect its own, and particularly in the absence of a parent or something, that there are support networks available.
Victor Hansen, a professor at the New England School of Law, he's been speaking with us about the issue of military service members losing custody of their children while they're deployed. Thanks very much for speaking with us, Victor.
You bet. Thank you.
Tomorrow on Here and Now, have you noticed you're spending a lot more than you used to at the supermarket? Well, we'll run a tab. And fact or fiction, food that you drop is okay to eat if you pick it up within 5 seconds. Well, you'll find out tomorrow. Still ahead, white lies in the workplace. Everybody's doing it. It's Here and Now. Support for Here, Deborah Becker, in for Robin Young, it's Here and Now. Do you ever lie at the office? Well, maybe lie is a harsh way to say it. Do you ever have to spin certain information while you're at work? Dr. David Shulman says most of us do, and most of us consider it a necessary evil of the workplace. He says that's why movies like Office Space, where office niceties are tossed out the window, resonate with so many people. Let's listen to this scene where the character Peter is suddenly truthful when asked to explain his job to two consultants looking to cut costs.
You see, what we're actually trying to do here is we're trying to get a feel for how people spend their day at work. So, if you would you walk us through a typical day for you?
Yeah.
Great.
Well, I generally come in at least 15 minutes late. I use the side door, that way Lumberg can't see me. And after that, I just sort of space out for about an hour.
Space out?
Yeah, I just stare at my desk, but it looks like I'm working. I do that for probably another hour after lunch, too. I'd say in a given week, I probably only do about 15 minutes of real, actual work.
That's from the movie Office Space, where the main character, Peter, honestly describes his workday. Well, Dr. David Shulman says these caricatures of workplace behavior contain a lot of truth about office lying. Dr. Shulman is an associate professor of anthropology and sociology at Lafayette College in Pennsylvania and author of the book From Hire to Liar, The Role of Deception in the Workplace. Welcome, Dr. Shulman, to Here and Now.
Hi, thank you very much for having me as a guest today.
Well, in your book, you say that one of your goals is to bring forward the role that deception plays in workplace culture. Can you explain exactly what you're talking about there and what kind of deception?
The kind of deception I'm interested in is everyday informal kinds of deceptions. People who are trying to take credit for work that they didn't do, people who act nicer to people they have a difficult time working with, service with a smile, even if you don't feel like smiling. And then also in situations where people have to look like a team player, no matter what their personal feelings are. So I was really kind of interested in the social situations inside an office that can affect people's everyday work.
Is there one particular anecdote that you heard that stands out in your mind of someone explaining why they were deceptive in the office?
There's a person who just used a very short remark, and they said, "You got to lie to get by."
Well, okay.
And, you know, it was short, sweet, and to the point. One sort of universal deception that I saw would be when people first started their jobs, there was kind of the same routine where somebody would say, okay, here's what you do. Now, do you have any questions? And people, almost to a person, would be afraid to say yes, they still did have questions because they didn't want to look bad. Mm-hmm. And then the boss in some of those situations is also giving really clear signs that, you know, they really don't want to hear more questions anyway. They want to be done with you. Well, in those kinds of situations, people go and they find another way to learn it without admitting that they just didn't really get it as fast as would be ideal. What became interesting during the course of doing the book is that people were, in fact, lying, but they weren't labeling their actions as lies. If I asked them to define deception, they would talk about evil criminal kinds of deceptions like stealing. thinks everyone knows are bad. But if I asked for a straight out definition of a lie, they would say things along the lines of, anytime you give an impression that you know to be inaccurate or false. And then I would go through the interview with people or be observing them, and they would do things like talk about exaggerating on their resume. And I would ask them, is that a lie? And they would say no. They would say it's just telling the most optimistic version of the truth. If there were people who, you know, I'd walk down the hallway and I'd be with somebody and they'd run into a person at work, they'd be like, hey, how are you doing? How are the kids? And then we'd walk down a few more steps and they'd be like, wow, I can't stand that blank, blank, blank. Mm-hmm. And I asked, is that deception? And they'd say, no, it's etiquette.
It is etiquette, isn't it?
It definitely is etiquette, but it's also a little bit more of a strategic etiquette and a little more self-interested sometimes than people want to acknowledge. They're also sparing themselves the hassles of dealing with the consequences of telling the truth. In the office context, there are a lot of stakes and vested interests in trying to always cultivate a good reputation and goodwill among people and looking like a team player.
So is it something then about the office that makes these things easier to rationalize?
There are so many varieties of ways that people can deceive. For example, managers can ask the people, just meet a goal. And they can know that to meet the goal might involve taking certain shortcuts, but they don't want to acknowledge that. The individual worker can go ahead and do that and just say that management wants it done. And in both kinds of cases, people rationalize away what's actually going to be going on without being accountable for it.
You mentioned that even though many of us go to many meetings throughout our time in the office, we really don't expect anybody to be very honest in a meeting forum. So people have to use covert means to actually figure out what the heck is going on.
There's a section in the book where I talk about subterranean education. And I think that's one of the kinds of situations where people go to meetings and sometimes they just know that they're watching a performance, but they don't really know what kind of realities might be underlining the performance. So they have to find out through covert means, or they engage in gossip and a whole bunch of other deceptive stuff that warms the cockles of my heart.
I wonder if lying or deception is in part an image thing. Would it then mean that the folks who have maybe more to hide, or at least think they do, would be more likely to be the biggest deceivers?
I think so. But on the other hand, they also run the biggest risk of getting caught. And people really aren't stupid. They can often see through other people's pretenses. Mm. So I think one of the things that's interesting about that whole question is not necessarily the degree of lying, but that there can be so much lying and people can't always openly call people out on it. They have to worry about the consequences. So it's not that people can't detect that the person is lying about when they say the work is going to be done or if they're taking credit for something that they didn't really do.
What about when things get away from the white into the very black? This is a definite dangerous lie, maybe criminal activity or something like that.
If lying becomes more routine, the lie may end up leading to certain kinds of ethical blind spots. They might become routinized. The more you remove the consequences, the more the darker lies can kind of sneak in that people wouldn't be comfortable with.
Can an office function well if people are completely honest all the time?
I don't think it would be a recognizable office. You know, even in a society of perfectly ethical people, there's going to be some kind of deviation that people are going to want to cover up.
Well, Dr. Shulman, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Thank you very much for having me as a guest.
Dr. Shulman is an associate professor of anthropology and sociology at Lafayette College. His new book is From Hire to Liar, The Role of Deception in the Workplace. Later in the show, an offbeat examination of the deep division between evolutionists and those who believe in intelligent design. You're listening to Here and Now. Watch me walking, walking out the door. Make it. Advertisers are using new technology to try to make sure you don't tune out their messages. They're sending them directly to your ears and your ears alone. It's made possible by something called Audio Spotlight, which does just what its name implies. It transmits sound in a narrow beam, almost like a beam of light, directly to a listener's ear. Court TV is using the technology and has installed special speakers in selected bookstores to market its upcoming crime series. Those who walk by its display of books hear this.
Over here. Don't turn around. Can you hear me? Do you ever think about murder? Committing the ultimate crime?
Audio Spotlight was created by Holosonics Incorporated of Watertown, Massachusetts. I asked company CEO Joe Pompei to demonstrate those beams of sound waves and explain his invention.
The Audio Spotlight is a new way of creating sound that, unlike a loudspeaker, creates sound that travels in very tight, narrow beams, much like lights.
So essentially, two of us can be sitting in relatively close proximity to each other. How close is what I'd like to ask you, and we'd be listening to different things.
That's right. In the living room example, you can be sitting within a few feet of each other, certainly on the same sofa, and you can listen to two distinct audio tracks, or one person can listen to sound and the other one can sleep quietly or read.
What about the car? This could be used eventually, you're hoping, in a car where, this is radio after all, a lot of people do listen in the car. If I want to listen to NPR, I could listen and my kids could listen to music and they could stop complaining about what I have on the radio. Is that right?
That's exactly right. We've actually been working with several car manufacturers and we've built many prototypes and they do work. We would embed Audio Spotlight systems right inside the passenger compartment of the vehicle, and each seat can choose the sound that they want to hear. So if your kids don't want to listen to NPR, but you do, you can turn on your NPR in your seat, and the kids can have whatever they want in their seats, and even the two kids in the back seat could listen to different sounds if they wanted to.
I imagine there are some people who might think it's invasive to have messages, you know, beamed at them so that only they could hear. What would you say to those concerns?
Well, I think most of those concerns I certainly understand, and I share them. But I think that a lot of that originates from really a misunderstanding of the technology. You know, the Audio Spotlight delivers sound to the places where people want it. If you don't want the sound, you can simply take two steps and then you don't hear it anymore. The idea isn't to give people more sound, it's to really reduce it and to give people only the sound that they want.
If we go back to the Court TV example just for a moment, and that is if someone's walking by a particular thing, they'll hear a voice whisper something in their ear. That strikes me as almost frightening in a way. How would someone know, for example, that it is something, it is an ad, and it's not maybe their ear playing tricks on them, or maybe their mind. Maybe they have some issue with hearing voices and they wonder if there's something happening with that. What do you do to take precautions to make sure that something bad doesn't happen from this?
Well, we just try to educate people as much as possible. For one is you can always look and see if there's an Audio Spotlight technology speaker there. The speaker will be somewhere, and it has to be line of sight. The sound beams don't go through walls or the ceiling and can't be done by satellites or airplanes or anything like that.
Can we listen and get a little demonstration?
Sure. Huh?
Okay, so right now we are in your conference room, and we each have two speakers above us, and I am hearing salsa. And you are sitting 3 feet away from me, and you have a speaker above your head. What are you hearing?
I hear John Coltrane, and I don't hear any salsa, and I only hear the saxophone solo.
You know what struck me as we were sitting very close to each other and hearing two different things is the isolating aspect of this technology. Is it, do you think, isolating in a way for both of us to be sitting right next to each other and listening to two different things and not sharing what we're listening to?
Well, I think sometimes, sometimes people do want to share what they're listening to, and I think they should be able to. But really what we like is that people have a choice. You know, maybe I'd like to sit next to you because I enjoy your company, but maybe I want to listen to something that I want to listen to, and you want to listen to something that you want to listen to. The Audio Spotlight technology, we can have it both ways. So maybe it's isolating sometimes, but it's really about choice. People can choose what they listen to and choose what they don't want to listen to.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Joe Pompei is CEO of Holosonics Incorporated, the Watertown, Massachusetts company that invented the Audio Spotlight. Still to come, what a flock of dodos can teach us about the difference between evolution and intelligent design. It's Here and Now. Deborah Becker, it's Here and Now. The age-old debate over the age-old question of where humans come from is the subject of a new documentary that uses the extinct dodo bird as its metaphorical focus. The documentary Flock of Dodos, The Evolution and Intelligent Design Circus premieres on Showtime tonight. It takes a somewhat humorous look at the bitter division between those who believe in evolution and those who support what's called intelligent design, the theory that the universe was formed by an intelligent master creator. Here and Now's Philip Martin has more.
If you're expecting a PBS version of the conflict between evolution and intelligent design, forget about it. Flock of Dodos, The Evolution and Intelligent Design Circus, is more Fahrenheit 9/11 than Eyes on the Prize, and writer-director Randy Olson is more Michael Moore than Ken Burns. The documentary puts angry evolutionists, neo-creationists, card-playing scientists, religious educators, and an octogenarian named Muffy Moose in the spotlight. As for the title...
These are dodos, and this is Muffy Moose, who lives in Kansas just around the corner from this man, who some people think is a dodo because of what he believes in. But if he's such a dodo, then why are these evolutionists so angry? Is it possible that they themselves are an entire flock of dodos? If they're so sure about our evolutionary past, then how is it 150 years after Darwin wrote The Origin of Species, we have this?
I don't believe that we actually descended from apes.
I do not believe that in any way, shape, or form we descended from apes.
I didn't believe that till I met my uncle who had more back hair than I have facial hair.
Since premiering at the Tribeca Film Festival in New York last year, Flock of Dodos has been ruffling the feathers of Charles Darwin's detractors and some of his supporters. The film debuted shortly after a Gallup poll showed that less than half of Americans believe in evolution. Many are convinced there are other explanations for the origins of life, notably...
Intelligent design.
Intelligent design.
Intelligent design.
Some intelligent design.
Intelligent design.
Director Randy Olson is a Harvard-educated evolutionary ecologist turned Los Angeles filmmaker.
What's fascinating is that I think most major evolutionists would concede that evolution was kind of grinding along down the mud 5 to 10 years ago, not getting a whole lot of attention in our society until intelligent design came along. And as intelligent design got on the front page of the newspaper, so did evolution. And it's certainly a much more intriguing topic today than it was 10 years ago. That's how I was able to make a film that actually plays to broad audiences. I don't think I could have done this 10 years ago.
The idea for the film began when Olson's 83-year-old mother, affectionately known as Muffy Moose, started sending him clippings from her local Kansas newspaper about efforts by the state's conservative-dominated school board to introduce intelligent design into the school curriculum. Kansas is where Olson's story begins.
Proponents of intelligent design believe that evolution, Darwinism, is incomplete.
You're not intelligent enough to dismiss the idea that there might be an intelligent design in the creation of the world.
And there's controversy tonight over the origin of life and how to teach it in school. A decision by officials in Kansas could have repercussions across the country.
The film moves back and forth between the views of evolutionists and their detractors, like Kathy Martin of the Kansas School Board, speaking here to director Randy Olson.
Yeah, I'm a Christian. I'm not going to deny that. I mean, I certainly am. I believe that God designed each one of us for something special, for a purpose.
And so you feel like the extrapolation of that is that he probably designed all the other creatures as well.
I certainly do.
Yeah, right.
And I think nature leads us to God if you let it, if you're not close-minded about it.
Tom Givnish is a professor of botany and environmental studies at the University of Wisconsin at Madison. Givnish sits around a poker table with fellow scientists discussing what they believe to be the danger of bringing the pulpit into the labs.
One should never mock people's religious beliefs. But when they come into the scientific arena and they start saying things that are manifestly wrong, that are manifestly ignorant, I think people have to stand up and say, you know, you're an idiot.
Some folks attending a recent showing of Flock of Dodos at Boston's Museum of Fine Arts were spotted nodding in agreement during that scene. When the lights came up, I went over to talk to some of them.
I believe evolution is right. I think it's pretty straightforward.
We haven't really gotten to evolution yet in school, but I am seriously against intelligent design.
I've never really heard what I felt like was a cogent argument for intelligent design.
I would definitely take a side for evolution. I think intelligent design is, as they portrayed it in that film, it's just a cover-up of a creationist trying to repackage them selling creationism in school system.
Jerry Swift was listening in nearby. The Lebanon, New Hampshire resident is an unshakable proponent of intelligent design. He was given permission by Randy Olson to set up a literature table in the hallway outside of the theater.
Did you manage to convince anyone or to at least sell some of the periodicals that you had on display tonight?
Well, I think you're right. It was a hard crowd in the sense that I didn't sell very many materials, and I did hand out a website, which was a counter website to the Flock of Dodos website called www.hoaxofdodos.com to correct some of the misgivings in the Flock of Dodos.
Hoax of Dodos is a web-based response from the Discovery Institute to Olson's controversial film. The Seattle-based organization describes itself as a Christian research think tank. It accuses the filmmaker of, among other things, exaggerating the methods the group uses to promote intelligent design. This from the film.
And how skillful is the Discovery Institute with communications? Well, for starters, they know who to hire. In the spring of 2005, they commissioned the services of the public relations firm Creative Response Concepts. The public relations firm that masterminded the Swift Boat Veterans for Truth campaign in 2004.
The Discovery Institute sent a letter to Showtime executives asking them not to air Flock of Dodos. Here's Randy Olson.
They're desperately clawing and clutching at straws to try and attack the film, which is kind of a shame because so many intelligent design supporters have actually thanked me for the film in that it is respectful of their side, their point of view. And furthermore, there's so much more powerful material to really insult and degrade and ridicule them that I did not put in the film.
Flock of Dodos has been screened in museums, universities, and in a few theaters around the country in the past 15 months. One of its biggest audiences, perhaps not surprisingly, was in Kansas. In the time since it aired in February of last year, a lot has changed. Significantly, the majority conservative Kansas school board was voted out of office in 2006. Kansas resident Muffy Moose, whose clipping sent her son off in search of dodos, credits the film for their defeat.
I hear from the people who believe the way I believe, and they have seen Flock of Dodos, and they love it, and they feel, and I feel, that the greatest thing Flock of Dodos does in the state of Kansas and many other places, is to make us aware of our voting power, and we better be alert.
But proponents of intelligent design say they will continue to press the issue, and some advocates for the idea actually praise Flock of Dodos for keeping the issue in the public spotlight. Jerry Swift was packing up religious brochures and books at the conclusion of the recent Dodo screening in Boston.
Overall, I thought the film was very educational. It told a lot about the history of what's happening in the overall public discourse of it. I think the film tended to look at what's happening culturally and historically in the U.S. And, you know, it is a mess in some ways. It is a, as he calls it, an evolution and intelligent design circus.
Well, you've told Adam, snakes, I've had them. Let's get out of here. Go raise this family someplace out of town. They left the garden just in time with the landlord cussing right behind. They headed east and they finally settled down.
That report from Here and Now's Philip Martin. Flock of Dodos, The Evolution and Intelligent Design Circus premieres on Showtime tonight.
Well, Charlie Darwin looked so far into the way things are. He caught a glimpse of God's unfolding plan.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. Join us again, Here and Now.
Paramecium right up to man. They'll have sex and mix up sections of their code. They'll have mutations. The whole thing works like clockwork over time.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI. Public Radio International.